Listen closely.
Hey folks, we're going to get the episode rolling in a second, but just a quick note. We read the story, The Beast with Five Fingers, using text pulled from the University of Adelaide's site, which has since gone down. After recording, when we found another source for the text to link out to, we realized we had been reading an earlier version of the story, which is different slightly from the story that appears most frequently, which is what we've linked out to. So when we complain in the show about there being no afterword, there actually is one. Although it doesn't do much in the way of explaining anything, I don't think. Anyhow, we just wanted to get that out up front. Thanks for tuning in, and here we go. It's The Beast with Five Fingers.
When I was a little boy, I once went with my father to call on Adrian Borlsover. I played on the floor with a black spaniel while my father appealed for a subscription. Just before we left, my father said, "Mr. Borlsover, may my son here shake hands with you. It'll be a thing to look back upon with pride as he grows to be a man." I came up to the bed on which the old man was lying and put my hand in his, awed by the still beauty of his face. He spoke to me kindly and hoped I should always try to please my father. Then he placed his right hand on my head and asked for a blessing to rest upon me. "Amen," said my father, and I followed him out of the room, feeling as if I wanted to cry. But my father was in excellent spirits. "That old gentleman, Jim," he said, "is the most wonderful man in the whole town."
HPPodcraft.com.
He's the most wonderful man in the town.
Nice.
But this is the most wonderful podcast for all your weird fiction wants and needs. The HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast. And I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer, awed by the still beauty of my own voice. Here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon.
Wait, who is that reader?
Why, that was friend of the show, Josh Peters. Josh is one of the foremost whiskey experts in the country. I don't know if you knew that.
I did.
Our listeners didn't, and I'm telling them now they can check out Josh's work over at thewhiskeyjug.com. That's his site with reviews on Scottish, American, Irish, Canadian, and world whiskeys, and lots more. What's good, what to buy, what to taste, if that's a spirit you caught into, and I'm seeing more and more people get into their whiskey, scotch, and rum these days. It's a lot trendier than it used to be. Make sure to check out The Whiskey Jug so you can get the good stuff.
This is the first time we've covered a story by W.F. Harvey. So who is he? What does he want? And where does he do his grocery shopping? Alas, I can only answer a few of these questions.
Okay.
William Fryer Harvey was born right here in West Yorkshire, in Leeds, which is where I game every week.
Yeah, Leeds is a sick gaming town, bro.
And we've had a live show there as well.
We have.
Harvey was born in 1885 to a Quaker family. Lots of Quakers around here.
Yo, Leeds is also a sick Quaker town, y'all. Games and quaking, rolling dice and experiencing God without any intervention. That's what it's all about in Leeds.
He went to school in Yorkshire, Reading and Oxford as well. He had his first book of short stories under his belt in 1910, which was called Midnight House. In World War I, he was with the Friends Ambulance Unit and later with the Royal Navy. He got lung damage, saving somebody's life, something that caused him health problems for the rest of his life. No good deed, of course, goes unpunished. So he wrote about his life in his memoir, We Were Seven. He published his second collection of short stories, The Beast with Five Fingers, in 1928 and Moods and Tenses in 1933. He lived in Switzerland most of his life, but moved back to England in 1935, then died 2 years later from, I guess, the food, probably.
Yeah, Leeds is also a sick Mexican food town. And by that, I mean, I ate a burrito there that made me sick. But Harvey was pretty young when he died, 52. I believe it was that lung damage that likely cut his life short.
The food here is fine. I'm
there's lots of great food in England. Not Mexican food, maybe not.
No. So the movie based on this short story, The Beast with Five Fingers, came out in 1946, and it gave Harvey some posthumous fame. They even released another collection of his unpublished works in 1951 called The Arm of Mrs. Egan and Other Stories.
Did you see that movie?
I have never seen that movie, no.
I remember it vaguely on cable as a kid, and I don't know if I watched it or just saw the trailer. I mean, I really remember Peter Lorre, but it came off as funny to me.
True.
Which, just the thought of a disembodied hand being scary at all is a little funny.
It
is its own trope. Like, it's almost its own monster, the crawling disembodied hand.
Yeah,
you've got Thing from the Addams Family.
Yes.
Which is comic relief for the most part. Also, all the madness with the hand in Evil Dead 2, which is both, you know, the hand possessed while it's on his body and when it's off of his body as an antagonist. Right. There's actually a new French animated film called I Lost My Body that's been cleaning up on the festival circuit.
Oh, really?
Apparently really good. Netflix swooped in and picked it up, so you can watch it there right now. I still need to check it out, but that's about a severed hand wandering around Paris, and somehow the story's told from its point of view, but it's a love story. I don't think it's a horror piece. But I'm sure there are a ton more autonomous severed hand stories out there. This one, I think he wrote it originally in 1919. Probably the Dracula for this specific type of monster. This is the seminal severed hand piece.
Sure, yeah.
And here we are talking about it 100 years later.
There you go. The Beast with Five Fingers begins with this guy, Jim, recounting his meeting with this Adrian Borlsover. When Jim met him, he was old and blind, but his father thought he was the bee's knees.
Jim was a kid and very impressed when this great man laid his hand on his head. And now we get a little background on Adrian Borlsover. Thanks for the last name that's impossible to pronounce.
Jeez, yeah. In his life, Adrian B. had been an expert on orchids, had really good penmanship, and was an awesome woodcutter. Good with his hands.
He had a congenital weakness of the lungs, which had caused him to move to this sunnier climate where Jim met him. So a little autobiographical stuff there. Mm-hmm. And Adrian also filled in occasionally for the local preacher. So he's good with his hands, but he's also good at sermons.
When he was 50 years old, he lost his sight, but was quick to adapt. He took to Braille like a fish to water. And by the end of his life, his powers of touch seemed uncanny. Powers of touch?
Yeah.
How does one measure powers of touch? I don't know what that means exactly.
What do you imagine? When they say that, they're talking about, you know, they said that he could tell at once the color of a ribbon placed between his fingers, which seems unlikely, but it's that kind of Daredevil level power of touch.
Oh,
you know how
yes.
Daredevil can read normal text. He doesn't even need Braille because
right.
His powers of touch are so...
You can feel the ink.
You can feel the ink raised
ink
from
on the
page.
Paper.
So, yeah, so it's that kind of thing. These are some very sensitive hands.
We get to the first chapter. Adrian never married. But now what happens to Jim? That whole thing is kind of an introduction to the story, but we don't get any more Jim after the fact.
No, it's just I wouldn't even call it a wraparound. It's just a little bit of an introduction. The only significance to it is that Jim felt the hand of Adrian Borlsover. But other than that, no real point to it.
Now we get into the first chapter. Adrian never married, but he had a nephew named Eustace. Eustace is a talented naturalist. He lived at Borlsover Conyers, the family estate, with his secretary, Saunders, a man, to work on his great book on heredity.
Apparently Saunders has some kind of dubious reputation. It's never explained, but his math skills make him very valuable as a secretary.
Eustace saw little of his uncle, maybe a couple times a year. 2 years before he died, Adrian developed the power of automatic writing, which he didn't even know he had. Eustace was the one that made this discovery. His uncle was reading Braille with one hand and then writing with the other. His hand was just writing family names.
Right. Adrian wasn't even conscious that this was happening. The right hand happened to have a pencil in it, and it's doodling while he's busy reading with the other hand. And it's just writing Adrian Borlsover, Eustace Borlsover, George Borlsover, Francis Borlsover. Honesty is the best policy. Beautiful Belinda Borlsover. King George III ascended the throne in 1760. Crowd, a noun of multitude, a collection of individuals. So these are all seemingly random bits of genealogy, history, dictionary definitions. Hmm. And the hand is just doing this all on its own.
As he writes, he talks to Eustace about the weather. So Eustace doesn't comment on the fact that he's writing while he's talking to his blind uncle. Eustace takes the book that he was writing in, and it's got a bunch of other nonsense in it. It says rows of capital letters, short words, long words, complete sentences, copybook tags. Eustace comes back to his uncle a few months later, and Adrian is not looking great.
Eustace finds him asleep and wonders if the automatic writing thing is still gonna happen. Adrian's hands are clasped in front of him as he lies there, and Eustace places a pencil and paper next to them just to discover if maybe he'll still do it. Pretty soon, the right hand creeps over, grabs the pencil, and starts writing. Mostly nonsense, like before.
Then Eustace asks, "Who are you?"
The hand writes, "Never you mind." Eustace asks, "Is it my uncle who is writing?" Response, "Silly Eustace, you'll see me very soon. When shall I see you?" "When poor old Adrian's dead." "Where shall I see you? Where shall you not?" Then the hand writes, "Adrian mustn't find us working at this sort of thing. He doesn't know what to make of it, and I won't have poor old Adrian disturbed. Au revoir."
So Adrian wakes up and he tells Eustace about this dream he was having of leaguered cities and forgotten towns.
And he also says, "Eustace, I want to warn you. Don't walk in doubtful paths. Choose your friends well. Your poor grandfather," and then he's cut off, "has a fit of coughing. Doesn't finish what he was going to say." So when he mentions Eustace's grandfather, I'm not sure what he's trying to say. This would be Adrian's father.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever he was trying to get out, his hand is communicating on somebody else's behalf, acting like a Ouija board, which that is what automatic writing is,
yes.
Right? Like in The
mm-hmm.
Changeling. And as he's parting from his uncle, he sees the last lines the hand wrote, which read, "It's too late, Adrian. We're friends already, aren't we, Eustace Borlsover?" This thing is communicating with him.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, he comes to visit his uncle, who is looking ill and despondent about his failed life. And Eustace comforts him. He says, "Oh, you're so educated." Adrian says, "Education is good so long as you know to whom and for what purpose you give it. But with the lower orders of men, the base and more sordid spirits, I have grave doubts as to its results." What does that mean?
You know, I'm not sure what a lot of this story means. And I feel like there's something going on here that I'm just not getting.
I don't think that's the case. I think it's left without description on purpose. It's the one weird element of this.
Yeah.
He mentions the grandfather, but gets cut off. He says, "Oh, education for lower orders of men. Its results might be bad." So I feel like, did his grandfather fall in with somebody bad, and that's the person who's writing with the hand, or is it the grandfather himself? I'm not sure.
Well, because he was writing all the names, all the people, maybe the lineage.
Yeah.
Maybe it's him, or we've got like a kind of a Charles Dexter Ward thing where there's distant relatives somehow are coming back spiritually maybe. Through the hand or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. And it's never explained. So Adrian tells Eustace to marry. Don't be like him. Find a nice wife. Also, I'm going to give you all my books when I die.
He also says, you know, before the end, people often lose control over themselves and make absurd requests. Don't pay any attention to them, Eustace. Bye.
But Eustace, he says, you're doing fine. You'll be alive for years to come. But of course, Adrian dies 2 months later.
Into the next chapter.
Now that Adrian has died, Eustace decides that he needs to convert the billiards room into a library since he's going to be getting all those books. Saunders tells him that he's gotten a lot of mail from Adrian's estate, but also a box with a rat in it. Now, he assumes it's a rat because it's scrabbling around inside. Eustace asks the butler, Morton, to fetch a screwdriver and open up the box. Now, Morton tells him that the postman said they poked holes in the box because there weren't any when they got it.
Now, everybody's being pretty chill about this. Everybody's really chill about everything in this story for some
reason.
Yeah,
really chill.
So, like, the severed hand hasn't even appeared yet, but just the fact that there's somebody sent a live rat in a box in the mail, it's like it's commonplace. Eustace is just kind of frustrated. Well, you got to give it air. Why didn't they do that at the post office, you know? Why didn't they do that when they sent it? He's not asking, why did somebody send me a live animal?
No.
He's just saying, why didn't they poke holes in the box?
Mm.
And then he figures, oh, I'll crack the box open, see what I got.
Eustace unscrews the box, but realizes he doesn't have a cage for the rat. So he puts a heavy book on the lid while he runs off to go find a cage.
Because who doesn't have empty animal cages lying around their library?
But on his way back, he hears something fall, and the box is on the floor, and the rat is nowhere to be seen.
He thinks, how am I going to find this animal now in this cluttered library?
Eustace can hear the thing scuttling about, but can't find it anywhere. He hears a couple of clicks, and the lights go out above. He gives up on his rat hunt and reads the letter from his late uncle's solicitor.
He just figures, I'll starve this thing out. I'm not going to keep looking for it, because he had heard it go up to the upper level of the library. He closed the gate to that upper gallery so the thing won't be able to get out of there. Time to just wait it out while he reads.
The letters are mostly about the valuable book collection, but also how at the last minute, Adrian's funeral arrangements were changed, and it was ordered that his right hand be sent to Eustace after his death. What? That's crazy. Yeah. Who does that? You can't send a body part, can you?
In 1919? Yeah, I guess so.
Can you do that now?
I don't know.
I wasn't going to write a real will, but now I am. If I could send people my body parts after I die, that would be awesome.
I'm like standing at the mail every day. Did I get anything from Chris? I thought he'd send me something, an ear or something.
So Eustace is a bit freaked out by this, but not really as freaked out as I would be.
But I guess this is the last minute absurd request Adrian was talking about. So clearly he was somewhat aware that his hand was possessed.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the request was most likely made in writing by the hand that did the automatic writing before. It wanted to be sent to Eustace for whatever reason.
Just then he hears one of the blinds snap up in the gallery and he thinks that, oh, somebody must be up there.
Yeah, that's a little complicated for a rat to do. So he heads up and he turns on the light.
When he goes into the room, he sees something unusual.
About 10 yards in front of him, crawling along the floor, was a man's hand. Eustace stared at it in utter astonishment. It was moving quickly, in the manner of a caterpillar. The fingers humped up one moment, flattened out the next. The thumb appeared to give it a crab-like motion to the hole. While he was looking, too surprised to stir, the hand disappeared around the corner. Eustace ran forward. He could no longer see it, but he could hear it as it squeezed its way behind the books on one of the shelves. A heavy volume had been displaced. There was a gap in the row of books where it had got in. In his fear lest it should escape him again, he seized the first book that came to his hand and plugged it into the hole. Then, emptying two shelves of their contents, he took the wooden boards and propped them up in front to make his barrier doubly sure.
He boxed it in.
Yeah.
Me, I probably would have gone catatonic after seeing proof that the supernatural is real.
Yes.
But he's a quick thinker and pretty cool about all this, I guess.
Really cool. Saunders is out and Eustace feels that he needs help. So he has Borton, the butler, give him plenty of booze. And then he tells him to go put the books away.
Yeah, the help he got was bring me brandy and clean up a little bit in here because some books have over. I don't think he lets him know that there's a hand wandering.
No, he doesn't. When Saunders returns, he lets Borton off the hook and he leaves.
He tells Saunders what's going on. He goes, it's his hand that's been playing old Harry all the evening, but I've got it cornered behind these books. You've got to help me catch it.
Of course, he thinks Eustace is putting him on. Eustace tells Saunders to put his hand in the hole to see for himself, which he does.
Yep.
It's crazy.
Well, he's not taking him seriously. He thinks it's just going to be some warm water in there or something.
He feels around and he goes, it's got a funny stumpy end to it, whatever it is. And it nips like a crab. Oh, no, you don't. And he says, it wanted very much to get a hold of me. I felt what seemed like a thumb and a forefinger. Give me some brandy.
I tell you, Saunders, it can cover the ground far faster than I could walk. So not only is this hand intelligent, it's also supernaturally fast, because I just can't buy that a hand would be able to move all that.
No way.
Fast.
Maybe. Somehow they manage to remove the books one at a time to trap the hand between two books. The thing seems strong for its size, but they manage to get it back into the box, screw the lid on, and then they lock the box up in Eustace's desk.
Saunders says, ah, done with that. Quite a lively evening, wouldn't you say? Let's hear more about your uncle. That's his reaction.
So they stay up all night talking about Adrian.
Which gets us into chapter 3 and the next day, in which they totally decide to just ignore the issue.
Yeah, since this is just too much to deal with, Eustace suggests that they leave everything and just go off to the Lake District. Saunders is like, maybe we should take a look at this hand. So they open up the box and the hand is room temperature, but it's not moving. And Eustace recognizes it as his uncle's hand. So Eustace says that they should lock the hand in the desk and just leave for a week for either Grantham or some other place. I guess Grantham's over east of Nottingham.
Right. Saunders says, oh, well, by tomorrow we shall have forgotten all about this beastly thing. What?
Yeah, that's insane. So a week later, Halloween, they're telling folks at a dinner party about their hand incident and, you know, getting a lot of mileage out of it.
Yeah, one of the guests responds, how perfectly horrid. Now tell us another one, do. Only a really creepy one, please. I guess they just don't believe that this actually happened to them.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty creepy that this is really a hand that they've got. I mean, it's still locked up back in his desk. Who are these people? That they're not flipping out about this.
It's bizarre. So the next day he gets a letter from his housekeeper that says she's quitting due to all the scary hand stuff that's going on. Is this story actually just about people ignoring problems and hoping that they're going to go away? Is that what this is?
I think so. I mean, it has to be, right? This has to be a comedic treatment to an extent because there's just nobody acting like a normal person. And they are just running away from their problems constantly.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody on the staff actually knows this is a hand. The letter doesn't specify that it is, but everybody's just freaked out because there's a thing that's creeping around the house, causing mischief. So obviously the hand got out of the desk.
They go back and try to convince the housekeeper to stay, but she won't. They ask Morton what's going on, and he says that he thinks it's a rat.
You know, the one of those mail-order rats that you didn't order, that one. Not all the other rats we have laying around.
Morton says that he let the hand out as per the note. Well, he doesn't say it's the hand. He thinks it's a rat. He got a note that Eustace wrote, and Eustace says, I didn't write any note. And then Morton goes, yeah, you did, and he shows him this note.
And then on the note it says, get a hammer, Morton, and break open the lock on the old desk in the library. Take out the box that is inside. You need not do anything else. The lid is already open. Signed, Eustace Borlsover. The butler apparently has never seen his writing before. And
I guess he bought
this letter, yeah.
So Morton says that the rat shot out and escaped. He didn't seem to notice that it was a disembodied hand because it just moved away so quickly.
Right, it was out too fast once he opened the box, so apparently he wasn't interested in what he was bringing. I mean, he just did exactly what was asked of him. He put the box on the desk, turned his back, and then whew, the thing got away.
So he tried to catch it, but he couldn't, and the hand has been terrorizing the help ever since.
Eustace figures out what happened. Because he sees the paper that the note's written on, he goes, oh, it's simple enough. That's my old stationery. I had a few sheets of it in the desk drawer. The hand must have gotten out of the box, found a pencil, wrote this note, shoved it through a crack in the dresser onto the floor where Morton found it. Because I guess the butler is in the habit of picking up letters from the floor and then following the instructions precisely. But Eustace says, it's plain as daylight that's what happened. I mean, their conversation is as commonplace about this hand as my wife and I playing, you know, where's that music coming from? Mute the TV. Is that coming from downstairs? Is it a car on the street? What is that? That's how they're talking about a disembodied hand in their house. Yeah.
It must be a comedy. It just has to be. There's nothing scary about this, even though it's supposed to be like a ghost story. It just seems so preposterous. Anyway, Saunders posits that the hand is not possessed by his uncle, but what was in his hand before he died is still there.
Right.
And now that his uncle is dead, the thing, whatever possessed him, is free to run around. So it says, for 2 days, nothing happened. Then Saunders saw it sliding down the banister in the hall. Whee!
He's a stagehand, this one. Loves to show off.
3 days later, Eustace sees it in the library on a book, feeling over the print like Daredevil or something.
Yep.
But the hand detects him and scurries up the curtains. Eustace has an idea to get the dogs onto it.
Although so far, this hand is just capering about and reading. No real danger yet, right? It hasn't showed up with a gun or a knife or anything yet.
No. So for 2 weeks, nothing. The hand is finally caught, but not by the dogs, but by the housekeeper's gray parrot.
Yes, this parrot, Peter, is a bit of an escape artist and routinely gets out of its cage. And this time it's gotten out again. It's perched up high on a curtain rod. And again, they're going to try and starve this creature out by just leaving it up there and closing the door. But then Eustace hears the parrot speaking. It says, "Scratch, poor Peter! Scratch poor old Peter!"
He looked up at the picture rail, and there was the hand holding on to the hook with three fingers and slowly scratching the head of the parrot with the fourth. The parrot shook its wings, preparatory for flight, and as it did so, the fingers of the hand got hold of it by the throat. There was a shrill scream from Peter as he fluttered across the room, wheeling round in circles that ever descended, borne down under the weight that clung to him. The bird dropped at last quite suddenly. Finger and thumb squeezed the neck. The bird's eyes rolled up to show the whites, and there was a faint, half-choked gurgle. But before the fingers had time to lose their hold, Eustace had them in his own.
Eustace has got a hold of this thing after it took a ride on the parrot's back and then strangled the parrot?
Yeah, it hates birds.
But he was being nice to it. He was, like, scratching its head.
Yeah, he was like luring it in. So the parrot would be like, "Oh, this is nice. Get closer." Then the strangling happens.
This story is so weird. Like, not weird with a capital weird.
It's weird that it's a disembodied hand doing it. But, like, that's how I strangle birds. Like, what it does isn't weird. It's just weird that it's a disembodied hand doing it. Last time I strangled a parrot, it went exactly like that.
He's got the hand, and he takes a look at it. It says there's a ragged gash across the back where the bird's beak had torn it, but no blood oozed from the wound. He noticed with disgust that the nails had grown long and discolored.
The thing, yeah, he's disgusted with the thing because it's not clipping its nails, not for any other.
So Saunders comes in to see what the fuss is, and Eustace says that he's got the hand, and it's limp. He supposes it's tired out from the struggle with the bird.
Oh, little guy.
It gets tired? The hand gets tired? Man, I got so many questions. He wants Saunders to
get... If you're just
a
hand strangling, that's like hugging somebody with your whole body for a long time.
But it doesn't breathe, and how does it like... Why does it get tired? It's a supernatural thing.
Breathe.
Anyway.
Wouldn't you get tired if you couldn't breathe?
True. He wants Saunders to get a board and some nails so they can nail this thing to a board and burn it.
Great idea. It says he took up a nail, and before Saunders had realized what he was doing, he had driven it through the hand deep into the board. "Oh, my aunt," he giggled hysterically. "Look at it now." But the hand was writhing in agonized contortions, squirming and wriggling upon the nail like a worm upon the hook. What's going on with these guys? He's like, "Oh, look at that. How hilarious." He's giggling about it. They nailed this devil's hand to the wood. So and Eustace, freaking. For some reason, he can't bring himself to burn it. It says he tried to throw it into the flames, but his own hands, as if restrained by some old primitive feeling, would not let him.
Mm.
So he thought maybe that's proof that it is a grandfather or something. There's some ancestral impulse that's keeping him from totally destroying it in that instant.
Right. So instead of throwing it in the fire, he locks it in his safe. They leave it in the safe and then forget about it again over time. And that gets us into chapter 4. Some time passes, 6 months, as a matter of fact. Eustace doesn't marry in that time. He likes his bachelor life, says he's too fond of old slippers and tobacco. Why can't you have old slippers and tobacco and still be married? I don't understand.
Old slippers and tobacco are two friends of his, actually. Oh. That's what's going on. He's polyamorous. They didn't have a name for it back then.
That's sure, of course. Things pretty much go back to normal. That is until there's a burglary at the house. Some plates are taken from the kitchen, and the safe was found empty.
The inspector who checks into this supposes that the thieves were experts, since they got the safe open. But there was an alarm of some sort, and they must have run off quickly before they could nick very much from the place.
So the inspector is puzzled by the fact that one of the crack burglars was foolish enough not to wear gloves.
Yeah, there are distinctive fingerprints all over.
And there's also a note left behind. It says, "I've got out, Eustace Borlsover, but I'll be back before long." So the inspector thinks that this must be someone that's just recently gotten out of jail.
And the inspector actually, he goes, "It must be some jailbird that just escaped. There's a written threat there," and the inspector's like, "We'll just keep a lookout, I guess." Like, somebody just threatened to come back and get him, you know? Everybody's so nonchalant. Eustace doesn't pony up any information about the hand to the inspector, because he probably would. At least he knows. It gives you some indication that he knows this is all very insane.
Yeah.
The fact that he isn't just telling everybody what it is. You know, his behavior says one thing, but the information he's keeping from folks tells you that he knows just as well as us that this is nuts.
So after the inspector leaves, Eustace says that he's out of here. He's going to Brain.
"I've got on far better during the last 6 months than ever I expected, but I'm not going to run the risk of seeing that thing again." So guy runs away from everything.
Again, yeah. So, of course, it's another amazing house that this rich dude has access to.
Yeah.
When they're unpacking, they discover one of the gloves has a hand in it. So Eustace throws it into the bathroom, into the bath, and they peek at it, and they see that it is seemingly trapped in the bathtub. It can't climb up the sides of it.
I love that it smuggled itself in a glove. Like, I found that very entertaining.
There it was, old and maimed, dumb and blind, with a ragged hole in the middle, crawling, staggering, trying to creep up the slippery slides, only falling back helpless. When Eustace tries to get something to keep it in, the hand crawls up the drain chain, and Eustace runs back in, grabs it, but it slips out of his hands because it's all wet from being in the tub, and goes right out the window.
See, I thought maybe Eustace was one of those guys that just has like a limp handshake. You know, you shake somebody's hand and you're like, ugh, it grosses you out because it's so weak.
Robert Smith of The Cure.
He had a weak handshake?
He had a weak handshake, man. He had the dead fish handshake.
Oh, it's the worst. Well, Robert Smith in this situation also wouldn't be able to contain the menace of the disembodied.
He would not.
Yeah, when's he going to write a song about that?
I still love Robert Smith. Just because he had a weak handshake does not make him a bad guy.
I'm never listening to The Cure again. I didn't know that. That sucks.
So for 2 weeks after that, Eustace is ill.
He suffered a great emotional shock, the doctor says, and the prescription, more running away. Saunders says, "Don't worry about it, old chap. This sort of thing can't go on indefinitely. You know, I saw it this time as well as you. It wasn't half so active. It won't go on living much longer, especially after that fall. I heard it hit the flags myself. As soon as you're a bit stronger, we'll leave this place. Not with bag and baggage, but with only the clothes on our backs, so that it won't be able to hide anywhere. We'll escape it that way." Why are they running away from it? Just deal with the issue.
Well, yeah, how do you deal with a disembodied hand? Just destroy it, I guess.
Exactly.
But for some reason, he can't destroy it.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe Saunders could, though.
But what he should have done is put it in a safe, then throw it in a lake or something like that. If you can't destroy it, if you're compelled to not destroy it, do something like that.
Yeah, but then 100, 200 years in the future, that safe corrodes. You've got, you know, an undersea kingdom that's been built by that point. The hand comes out. Now we've got a futuristic underwater society being menaced by
a disembodied hand.
A disembodied hand. Wait a minute. Actually, yeah, I like that story.
You got a new screenplay, Fiverr. Eustace wonders why it's coming after him. And he says this to Saunders. And then he goes on and says, "I'm no worse than other men. I'm no worse than you, Saunders. You know I'm not. It was you who were at the bottom of that dirty business in San Diego, and that was 15 years ago.
What's that all about?
I guess that was the reference in the beginning that Saunders was up to some shenanigans, and I guess there was some burglary or robbery or some kind of crime thing that happened in San Diego.
It's never explained, so
no.
Did the hand get possessed by something that they did in San Diego? I don't know.
Saunders believes that the hand is just evil and has its sights on Eustace because he put a nail through it.
Yeah, that tends to make people mad, yeah.
Yeah. So they plan to leave on the 1st of September. So the night of August 31st, Eustace gets a note delivered by the housekeeper from the hand. And it says, "Will 11 o'clock tonight be suitable for our last appointment?" At 11 o'clock, they hear a knock on the door from the lower panel. So it's the hand knocking. Mm-hmm. Eustace and Saunders lock the door. Saunders then checks that all the windows in the room and the bathroom are locked and sealed. But then he hears this tapping at the window, and it's the hand. It's got a pocket knife, and it's trying to like pry open the window.
How does that, work mechanically with physics and everything? I know it's supernatural, but how could the hand exert any pressure with no muscles to push it forward?
Maybe if it held something with its thumb and forefinger and then just braced itself with its other fingers and then pushed off of it. I don't know. This is all preposterous.
No, that's how it works. I get it. Now it's scary. Before it was just funny. Now you explain that to me, I'm fucking scared.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that to you. So Eustace says they're screw latches. That thing can't get in with a knife that way. They don't work that way mechanically. But quickly, Saunders realizes that the thing can get in via the fireplace. So he quickly goes to get a fire started.
This is what I was thinking the whole time. Why don't they just let it in and then beat the crap out of it? Yeah. It's right there. Let it go ahead and fiddle with the thing. Once the window's open, grab it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Break all its fingers. I don't know. It just seems, instead of running away from the problem, I feel like they should just deal with it. But you're right. I guess they have some compulsion to not burn it or whatever.
But here's the thing. It's Eustace that has the compulsion, not Saunders.
That's
so why isn't
saying,
Saunders
yeah,
taking care of business?
I don't know. Well, right now they're trying to take care of business as quickly as possible because they think it will come down the chimney. Time to start a fire. They rush to do it because they can actually hear it now creeping down the chimney. So first, Saunders shoves a bed sheet up there to keep it out. Always good to shove linen up in a fireplace.
Yeah.
And then Eustace uses some reading lamp oil to throw, you know, to get a fire started quick. So he throws all the oil in there. He says, oh, pull that sheet out of there because I got a fire going now.
There was a great roar from the grate as the flames shot up. Saunders had been a fraction of a second too late with the sheet. The oil had fallen onto it. It too was burning. The whole place will be on fire, cried Eustace. He had tried to beat out the flames with the blanket. It's no good. I can't manage it. You must open the door, Saunders, and get help. Saunders ran to the door and fumbled with the bolts. The key was stiff in the lock. Hurry, shouted Eustace. The whole place is ablaze. The key turned in the lock at last. For a half second, Saunders stopped and looked back. Afterwards, he could never be quite sure as to what he had seen. But at the time, he thought that something black and charred was creeping slowly, very slowly, from the mass of flames towards Eustace Borlsover. For a moment, he thought of returning to his friend, but the noise and the smell of the burning sent him running down the passage, crying, "Fire! Fire!" He rushed to the telephone to summon help, and then back to the bathroom. He should have thought of that before, for water. As he burst open the bedroom door, there came a scream of terror, which ended suddenly, and then the sound of a heavy fall.
And that is the end of the story.
There you go. That's the end.
It's really a prequel, the story we suggested earlier, By Hand or By Sea, which is about the underwater. As much as I could come up with on short notice. That's the working
That's
title
good.
Right now.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
You know, I just was, when I read this the first time, I just kind of thought, okay, whatever. I think the plot of the movie is much different from this. It's about a pianist, I think. So, you know, they bring up the skill of the hands that way. It's got a lot more plot going on than this does. They probably take a couple things out of it for the movie.
Do you remember a movie from like either the late 70s or early 80s with Michael Caine? And I think it was called The Hand, where he was a writer, a pianist. No, he was an artist. And his hand got lobbed off in a motorcycle accident or a car accident. And then he's haunted by his disembodied hand because they never find it. And I think it's like a psychological thriller. I saw it when I was a kid a bunch. And I think there's some sex and stuff in there. So that's why I watched it.
Yeah.
You know, when I was like at that age, 12 or 13 or whatever, when it was on.
You're at that age when you want to see Michael Caine's dong. I get it.
Of course. Well, what age is that? Not. All ages want to see Michael Caine's dong. But he didn't show his dong. Obviously, it's the 70s or 80s. You don't see dong in movies at that time.
Oh, now
there's dongs aplenty. There's dongs all over the place.
Sure.
But back then, you didn't get much dong. And you keep hoping. Every time you watch it, you think maybe this time I'm going to see Michael Caine's dong.
Yeah.
But no, it's the same movie.
Why? That's why I watch Muppet Christmas Carol over. I thought for sure this time. But no. People do have issues. There's a thing called, you know, it's funny, right before we jumped on the show, I was reading the Times this morning. One of the opinion writers wrote an article in there about politics.
Yeah.
The intro paragraph says, H.P. Lovecraft was a writer of weird fiction in the early 20th century who had protagonists up against incomprehensible evil. And then the next paragraph, it goes, the situation right now is exactly like that. And it's not. Like, it was very, very clear that this opinion writer loves Lovecraft and was just shoehorning it in there however he could. Because it really had nothing to do with what the
article. Nothing to do with it. No. everything that's going on in our world, good or ill, is of man and nature. You know, it's not of this other thing that is beyond comprehension.
Know. It was
it's
just all... such an obvious, like, I'm going to work Lovecraft into this article somehow. Anyway, so we read this, I'm doing notes on this, and I go, you know, I remember there's this thing called alien hand syndrome.
Oh, what's that?
Which happens a lot with people who get Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, you know, the mad cow disease.
Oh.
And I go, you know, I actually, back when I was a short-lived time as a medical journalist, I was writing articles, content every day on medical stuff for the internet. And I go, I remember I wrote something about alien hand syndrome. Let me pull up the Word doc. And then this is what I wrote. In Sam Raimi's classic horror film, Evil Dead 2, the main character, Ash, suddenly finds his hand possessed by otherworldly forces. In one particularly messy scene, the hand throws him around a kitchen, making him smash dishes over his head and punch himself in the face. How does Ash stop his own hand from killing him? He maniacally severs it from his arm with a chainsaw. Second paragraph. Although his solution is extreme and medically unsound, Ash's predicament is not unknown to some people with a rare syndrome called alien hand. These people, usually former victims of a stroke, infection, or brain surgery, feel disconnected from one of their own hands, sometimes believing that the limb is possessed by an unknown force. So I did the same thing!
You did it. Yeah.
I mean, it's a little more connected, but at the same time, I just wedged it in there because I was bored writing these articles and wanted to mention Evil Dead 2, you know? Because
you love Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
There's no harm in that.
But it was funny. I just made fun of that guy and not a half hour later caught myself doing the
exam. Amazing.
But yeah, the alien hand syndrome thing is really strange because people will be... I've seen video, too, where... You know, somebody will be standing there talking and the handles start to raise up or start fiddling with the bra strap or, you know, they have no idea what their own hand is doing.
We've all learned something, I think, today, discussing the beast with five fingers.
Yeah, we all have.
I would like to thank our patrons for supporting us in this learning. And I want to name them and say thank you.
Okay, let's start with, I want to thank Ellis Morris.
I'd like to thank Ashton Mead.
Mary Kate Jenkins, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank M.D.
Those are initials. I don't know whether that's actually a medical doctor or not. David Eloy, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Greg C. Haley.
Christopher Huning, thank you.
And Daniel, thank you so much.
Matthias Hansen, thank you.
And Frank Lewis, thank you.
On top of all that, I want to give a very special thanks to our reader today, Josh Peters. Josh, glad to finally have you on the show. Don't forget, folks, to go check out thewhiskeyjug.com. That's all we have for this week. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lankin. You've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
HPPodcraft.com.